Today's program was brought to you by Eating Tools, unique handmade eating and cooking tools. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Andrew?
Yes.
I love that new montage. It is so fun.
Thank you very much. I have to be honest, it is a direct lift from the tennis podcast. You're looking at me funny, but they use obviously tennis players in an opening montage, and I've always loved it. And so I badgered all my guests in the first, or not, I sometimes forgot or we got pressed for time, but I asked them to do those little promos and then we cut them all together.
Yeah, it totally works. It
Thank
was
you.
Really fun.
Yeah, but it is a ripoff from the tennis podcast. Anyway, hi everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs, and it's great to be back with you all for the first time in 2018. If you're not familiar with the show, we usually do an introductory section where I'm joined by my wife, Caitlin, who's here again this season by popular demand, Caitlin. I've gotten, I think, more comfortable doing these openings, but people like having you here. So we're renewing your contract.
Okay. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you very
much. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. So a couple of things. I spent some time over the holidays listening back to several of the shows. And I have decided that these intros are too long. I love talking to you, but they're too long. So I am out of the corner of my eye looking at the clock, and I'm going to try to keep us to about 5 minutes, listeners. I'm going to try to keep us for 5 minutes. That's the challenge I'm throwing down to myself. You don't think I can do it?
No, I'm laughing because I of course people don't want to hear us ramble for more than that. Like five
well,
sounds
we
about
say
right.
Some substantial things, but anyway, at the top of the show here, I am going to say this is something I decided we didn't do a good enough job of last year. Who our guest is, and our guest is Chef Missy Robbins of Lulia Restaurant in New York City.
One of my absolute favorites.
We'll say a little bit more about that in a minute, but just to keep you all engaged, that is who our guest is. But we do have some I guess we'd call this housekeeping or some news to share. First of all, on a serious note that I'm not going to let drag the show down again, at the end of the year, in the wake of some of these harassment and assault stories that broke in the industry, I was very eager to do a special report on that topic. Had a really hard time getting anybody who wanted to interview. I am now teamed up with Allison Robicelli, who is based in Baltimore, who's been very outspoken in the industry on this topic. And Allison and I are going to co-produce a special report over the next several weeks. We're working on some interviews together. She and I will speak to each other as part of that show and hopefully are on the way to having some fairly important voices on this topic joining us. And it'll be a series of 4 or 5 interviews that we're going to air as a special report. So I just wanted to let people know that that is in the works. And I'm excited. I'm excited to be working with Allison. It's kind of a grim subject, but I'm glad we're doing it. I think it's important.
Yeah, it's important.
And I've said it before, I don't know how to do a show called Andrew Talks to Chefs and not get into that. Secondly, I have a new book coming out. I don't want to overly plug the book on
Andrew,
the show.
Andrew, don't be too modest. This is your listeners are exactly the people that want to read this book.
That is true. But I don't like to, I don't know, it's hard for me to ask for stuff. But I do have a new book. It is called Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession. And it is about I call it the American chef explosion that happened from the early 1970s to the early 1990s. You could say it's the story of the American chef from Chez Panisse to the Food Network would be one way somebody put it to me. In any event, I did more than 200 interviews with chefs from all over the country. I don't know why people keep saying to me, oh, it's the California chef book. It's not that. It's large. There's a lot of California in there, but it's about what happened across the United States during those years and sort of the creation of this profession here. That book publishes February 27th. It's available for pre-order at places like Amazon now. So A, I'm bringing it up because I thought people might want to know about that book, but also that book is going to take me around the country. Maybe I'll get to meet some of you. I will be saying more about this on my blog, tokeland.com, which I haven't posted on in forever, but I am starting to post there again this week. And I'm having a special events and engagements pages created, which will tell people where you can find me, but I'll be in Los Angeles three times. I will be in San Francisco. I will be in Napa. I will be at the Philadelphia Chefs Conference in March. All these places I just named are going to happen between the end of February and early April. And there'll be some other events, and I'm really looking forward to getting out there. Again, I hope to meet some of you. And the other great thing is while I'm in these markets, because I only do in-person interviews for this show, I will be hoping to interview several people, both people who are sort of legends who are featured in the book and also younger chefs who I might be able to get time with while I'm on the road. So it'll really add value to the show for everybody. You keep looking at my notes. Why do you keep looking at my notes?
Because I'm wondering if we're going to hit the 5 minutes.
We failed. We got 1 minute. I can't do it. We're going to come close. Okay. I think that's everything I needed to say about that. Missy Robbins is our guest this week. And Missy is, at the moment, the chef of my personal favorite restaurant in New York City. And that is Lilia Restaurant in New York City. This month, it celebrates its second anniversary.
Already?
Yeah. I know, right?
Yeah.
I know. And Missy is, it's an Italian restaurant. She's American. She half thinks of herself, I think, as Italian. She says as much in her book. Her book, which came out in the fall, is called Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, Life. And it is a wonderful collection of recipes, but also it's half a memoir, really. And I think I personally, although I don't know her that well, and I haven't known her that long. We only know each other because the only way I could get into that restaurant was to get her email address from a mutual friend and write to her and ask her for some help getting a reservation because we tried to go so many times and it's just a really hard table.
Yeah.
And she could not have been nicer. We met. We had, I think, an instant simpatico. We're at similar places, I think, in our lives. She's a real thinker. She's really introspective. She's gone through a lot of personal changes in the last few years, which I'm not talking out of school. She gets into all that in her book. And we talk about all that in the interview. And just to orient you guys, Missy trained in Chicago. She was for years at Spiaggia Restaurant in Chicago, working for Chef Tony Montuano, who's just the sweetest, most sort of avuncular guy. And then came to New York, worked in several restaurants in New York, started to really, I think, get known when she took over A Voce. She was not the original chef of that restaurant, but became that chef and put her own stamp on it. And then after a hiatus, opened Lilia, which is in this big, airy corner location in Williamsburg. It really kind of owns its neighborhood. It's like a beacon.
It's such a pretty, pretty restaurant.
Yeah, it's very rustic. It's very pretty. It's got very warm service. It's high-ceilinged. And there is an open kitchen that Missy presides over. And, I mean, we've largely gotten to know Missy visiting at the pass, which, you know, is not probably the most considerate thing for us to do, but you know, she's put herself there.
But she's so nice, and she's standing right there.
Yeah, and she's an absolute sweetheart. And so as a personal indulgence, I asked her if she would be the first guest of season two. I feel like, you know, I paid my dues in season one, and I don't mean that I didn't have guests that I loved. I loved all our guests. But as a gift to myself, I'm starting the year off with Missy Robbins. And we recorded this interview, to be honest, in December. When we could, when we both had the time in our schedules and we could get to each other. And I guess that's all I'm going to say about it, Caitlin. That's all I'm going to say. I probably could say more, but I did okay. Not 5 minutes, but not like, not even 10.
Pretty good.
We did about 8 minutes. Not the worst.
You were great.
Not the worst. Okay. With that, here you go. This is my interview with Chef Missy Robbins, recorded at Lilia Restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, last month. I hope you enjoy it. So Missy, we are sitting here. I don't want to deceive the audience because this is our first show of season two, which airs in January. It's the new year, but it's not the new year.
Correct.
We're sitting here
close
to the new year, but still at the sort of height of the holiday season. If you imagine yourself listening back to this at the beginning of the new year, what are you kind of hoping for yourself at the beginning of the new year in terms of calm, restoration? Like what does New Year sort of mean for you, being a chef and being in this business?
I've had a really busy and hectic and crazy 2017.
Right.
So I'm just looking forward to newness in 2018. Health, happiness, productivity, and calm, I think is the right word. Yes.
So that's how you, when you're sitting listening to this, that's how you, the Missy of December 2017 imagines the Missy of 2018
yes,
in January.
Yes. I'm going to try my hardest.
So, well, you know this. First of all, it's great to be sitting here at Lilia. As you know, right now, I think this is probably my favorite restaurant in New York City.
Thank you. You know that means a lot.
Thank you.
Because I know you have a lot of favorite chefs in this industry and favorite
yes.
restaurants. And,
yes.
I'm happy to be of the moment for you.
Thank you. You look vaguely, I don't know what, embarrassed when I tell you
no.
that. Is it a weird thing for someone to tell you that? I can't be
no,
the only person telling
good.
You that.
It feels good every time. It feels good every time, but I don't take it for granted, I guess, when people... We've been so lucky at Lilia since we opened, and it's been such an... We're going to be 2 years old in January.
Happy birthday.
So that's super exciting, and it feels like it's been 10 years and 3 months all in the same time.
Sure,
and,
I'm sure.
And I think I just... I don't ever want to take for granted how people have responded to the restaurant, because people... journalists and our neighbors and people from all over the world have come here, and they've been so excited about what we created here, and it took so long to create this, both along a lifetime of a career.
Yeah.
I feel like this is sort of a culmination of everything I wanted to do, but things I didn't even know I wanted to do also.
Yeah.
And I just don't take it for granted that people love it. It makes me feel good every time, but maybe there's a little bit of a, I still can't believe that people like this restaurant as much as they do.
Uh-huh.
I was terrified to open it. I had disappeared off the scene for a couple of years almost, and I certainly wasn't as well known pre-Lilia as post-Lilia.
Yep.
And that's been an interesting process for me as well. And So I'm just sort of grateful for the response, because I feel like I took this sort of risky move of coming to a neighborhood that I didn't know and a borough I didn't know at all.
Yeah.
And it could have gone one of two ways.
Right.
and I always knew when I decided to do this, I sort of said, okay, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? The worst thing that can happen is it's not successful and I open another restaurant somewhere else, or I go get a job.
Right.
Like what's the worst thing that can actually happen? And it's been beyond what I could have ever imagined.
Yeah.
So you kind of talk about the holiday season. The holiday season and June are the same to me. They're equally as busy here, partially because we have an outdoor and we have 36.
We
6 months of the year we have outdoor seating, and it's 36 extra seats. So it feels busy here all the time, and the holiday season is a little different in terms of how people eat and some larger parties and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's really, to me, it's just kind of all one, blends
That's
into
interesting.
One thing.
I mean, when you just said you hadn't been in Brooklyn before, did you?
Literally.
Not just working, like hadn't set foot?
Literally. No, I had set foot, but not very often.
Did you make any kind of concessions, or did you try to sort of second guess yourself in terms of what that meant, or did you just decide to sort of go all in on a restaurant that would represent sort of you and your ideas and your aesthetic? What is Lilia to you?
It's such a great question, because so much through the building process of Lilia, people would say, well, it's in Brooklyn, you have to X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And it started to get really annoying to me.
Did it?
And
what kind of stuff?
Whatever. Service, uniforms, whatever. Like, right. Don't make it too fancy. Don't do this. Don't do that. You can't do this. Like, just everything. From, like, a napkin to a glass to whatever. And
this was all unsolicited, I assume.
Everything's usually unsolicited when people are asserting themselves in that manner. And I hadn't spent enough time in Brooklyn to sort of care or know, and I definitely listened, and I thought about obviously pricing and making sure that we were accessible to the neighborhood, and those kinds of things were very impactful for me, and those were important. But those were important because of the restaurant I wanted to have.
Right.
Lilia for me, in the most basic form, was what is the restaurant that I want to go to every day. And I always wanted to create a restaurant that, where would I want to go on my nights off? Where, what do I want to eat when I'm at home? What do I want to drink? How do I want to be treated?
Yeah.
Who do I want to be my server? How do I want to feel when I leave the restaurant? And so it was this sort of culmination of a certain cooking style that I had developed over many years, but sort of, I really toned it down and pulled it back, and sort of took many years of cooking at places like Spiaggia and Avoce, where the food was very, very refined.
Yeah.
To keeping those same principles in the food of execution, but saying how do we make this really things that people want to crave? And that to me, when people kept saying, well, how do you want the food to be? And I just kept saying craveable. And I didn't know 100% what that meant.
But it meant something to you.
Crave certain dishes around, you know, I go to Isodi a lot, and I crave very specific things there. And so to those restaurants, to me, at this point in my eating career, are more important than kind of getting to the newest, hottest place.
Yeah, sure.
And so I wanted Lilia to have that feel, and I didn't know what those dishes would be, which is the funny part, because you design a menu and you say, oh, that's going to probably be the most popular thing on the menu,
right.
And that's not what happened. So I think, like, a very basic thing like chicken is a great example. I have a chicken leg and thigh here. We sell, I don't know, like 4 a night.
Yeah.
At Avoce, I sold 50-something chickens a night. And I think what happened here is there's enough other variety, and the way the menu is designed, it gives people all these other opportunities to eat differently and not go to the thing that's safe, but go to things that sound really tasty.
Yeah.
And the chicken dish that we have here is awesome, but I don't care that it doesn't sell as well as everything else. I have it on because I like it. I like to eat chicken. Yeah. I think it's great, but it hasn't become this like important thing. The malfadini was sort of put on, which has become the malfadini with pink peppercorns, Parmigiano Reggiano, and butter. It has 3 ingredients in it. That's it.
Yeah.
It's a squiggly long pasta shape. It's got awesome texture. It's got awesome sort of rusticity and bite to it. And I sort of put it on as a joke to myself and said, I'm going to put on this pasta that's so simple. I wonder if people will like it. And it became the most Instagrammed thing in the restaurant. It became the thing that was the biggest seller. It's now the second biggest seller. So you never quite know what's going to resonate with people.
Yeah.
And I thought the rigatoni with spicy red sauce was going to be that thing.
Yeah.
And it's popular, but it's not the malfadini.
I wonder if you agree with me. My feeling is that with almost anything, let's say creative, you have to be, it sounds like a cliche, you have to be true to yourself. If you're not, if you're trying to just second guess people, if you're trying to put your like a marketing executive hat on, it will show. It just will. It'll show in the case of a chef. It'll show in the food. In the case of a writer, it'll show in the writing. In the case of a filmmaker, you know, I remember when I was a kid and I thought I was going to be in the film business, and Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, and we were all crazed, you know, worshiping Steven Spielberg. And I remember him giving interviews where he said, "I make the movies I want to see." Right?
Same thing.
And
so
you made the restaurant you wanted to come to and eat at.
And I hoped that people would like it. I didn't know. And I think I think when one of the most, you know, for me, that one of the greatest things about the past couple of years is I did stay true to myself. And I was worried that people were going to be like, "What's she doing? Why does she have rigatoni with red sauce on the menu?" And I didn't care. You know, I came from environments that were very focused on things like Michelin stars and attaining them and maintaining them and New York Times reviews and things like that. And I consciously sort of made a decision that I just wanted to cook and see how people liked it.
Yeah.
And obviously, if people hadn't liked it or if they weren't responding, I would have had to make adjustments and do things. I was very lucky. I didn't have to do that. People responded to what I was doing. But I think when you take... when you take all those things away and you say, "I'm just going to cook and see if people like it. I'm just going to create a very simple cocktail menu. I'm going to, you know, people want to drink Negronis and Aperol Spritzes. I don't need 10 fancy cocktails on the menu here. We have a couple cool things that you won't find other places, but I didn't need this whole mixology thing. I wanted a certain level of simplicity.
Yeah.
And that's not to take away from those things in other places, because I love going to places and trying new things and seeing new things. But for here, I wanted this to be the place that you wanted to come once a week or two times a week or three times a week and know that you would always get those things. So there are 15, 17 menu items on now that will never go away.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's about half the menu. So we have close to 30 menu items at any given time.
Yeah.
And the other kind of 15, whatever, 10, 15 change seasonally or when I'm bored or whatever. But there are definitely pastas that will never go away here. There are meat dishes that will never go away.
Yeah.
And I didn't 100% intend to have so many things that never went away, but I did intend to have a core of things that weren't seasonal, that had nothing to do with a particular vegetable or whatever, that would be able to travel the four seasons and where I wouldn't have to think about it, because my approach previously, I changed the menu when I was at Avoce every 3 to 5 weeks.
Wow.
At both restaurants, six new dishes in each, seven new dishes, including dessert, at each restaurant relating to a region of Italy every 3 to 5 weeks. And it was intense and it was educational for my staff and for myself. We went through the regions four times while I was there. So it was intense, but it was an enormous amount of work, like enormous. And it put an enormous amount of pressure on ourselves. I mean, it was all me. I'm the one who wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I knew that here I wanted it to be a little bit more, I don't know if relaxed is the right word, but I didn't want to put that pressure on myself to constantly have to change all the time, and I didn't want to put it on my staff.
Yeah. So what's the most surprising thing here that connected with people? Whether it's something about the design, the menu, the for you?
I don't think there's anything surprising that connected with people. I think what is awesome for me is that people have responded amazingly to the food, but every night people say, "Oh my God, your playlist is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh my God, we love your staff.
Yeah.
Your staff is so lovely." And that was something that was really important to me, is hiring nice people who could connect with our guests and treat them like family. And, you know, we built this restaurant to make people feel like they were coming into our home. It's sort of how the kitchen is designed, that it's very fluid between the dining room and the kitchen. And I don't really make table visits as much anymore because people just constantly come up and talk to me at the pass. And
guilty.
I love it though. There are nights when you don't want to talk to anyone.
Yeah.
And you know, I talk about it in the book that I built myself this stage by mistake, and you can't hide when you do that. There's no doors to go behind. There's no real office here.
Yes.
There's nowhere for me to go to hide.
Yes.
I take a lot of walks, whether it's cold or hot, when I need privacy.
Yeah.
I've gone around this block 400 times.
Yeah.
But that to me has been amazing, and even in you know, thinking about next projects and building new restaurants, I think the same way. How do you have that interaction between the guest and the kitchen?
Yeah.
And it's not just me. People love watching the cooks, and they always say, oh, your kitchen's so calm. How do you keep them so calm? And it's just sort of, it's everyone's having a good time together. And,
yeah.
and that's been really cool for me.
That's great.
I'll never, I mean, unless I have to due to a architectural constraint,
yeah.
I will never build a closed kitchen again.
Is that right?
No way. I love being part of the action. I love that I can watch what's going on in the dining room. I love that I can interact with guests that I know and that I don't
yeah.
know without kind of leaving the kitchen. I've structured it so I don't have to stand in one place all night and that I can move around.
It's sort of the restaurant equivalent of like the open floor plan office space that has become so
a little
accepted
bit.
Now in corporate America.
Yeah, it's just for me, I don't want to be behind closed doors just with a group of guys in the kitchen and girls in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I want to be kind of part of it all, and it makes you closer with your wait staff.
Yes.
You know, I'm not just the chef that I'm in the back and they have to come talk to. I'm in it all night. And
yeah.
and I think that makes I'm 4 feet from the bartenders, you know?
Yeah.
So I just think the vibe of having this sort of more communal place has been really amazing for me.
That's great. Well, it also is it I don't know how to ask this question. I think you really have to know who you are to be somebody who occupies a public spot as a chef in a restaurant, at the helm of an open kitchen. You know, some people have very different personalities with different people in their lives.
Oh, I know what you're getting at.
No, but I mean, I think, you know, it could be an identity crisis for some people. Like, are they a certain way with their cooks versus, what did you think I was getting at? Like this
know.
Kitchen screamer or something?
No, first of all, having an open kitchen definitely makes you behave. You have to behave.
Yeah.
Makes
everyone behave.
It makes everyone
yeah,
behave.
Which
it
is
makes
a good
every
thing.
Single person behave. And that's
yeah.
not why I did it, but it definitely is a result of that.
It
helps
people keep their stations clean.
I think, like I said, look, there are nights where you don't want to talk to anyone.
Right.
And I went through many of them. I've gone through... I'm a human,
yeah.
so I have moods, I
yeah.
have issues in my life, I have things, and I did put myself in the public, and people
yes.
come here and they want to talk to me.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's my friends, and sometimes it's colleagues of my partner, and sometimes it's strangers.
Yeah.
And I put myself in a position where I want to be friendly and where I am forced to be friendly.
Yes.
And it takes you out of your shell a little. I think I've become more comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
I think I was comfortable in my own skin when I opened. I was 44 when we opened. I'm 46 now. I think I've gained a lot of maturity over the last few years, but I think that, I don't think my personality changes between one or the other, but I definitely think it forces you to have a personality and to, you can't hide. Like
mindful
there's just
it.
No hiding.
It forces
hiding.
You to be mindful.
There's just no hiding.
Yeah. yeah. So it's funny. I've been listening back to a lot of the shows from the first season. I usually, this is about the time that I start to try to wrestle things over to like a chronological, biographical, but I'm going to not do that right now.
Because I'm
okay.
so old and it's so long.
No, because we're just
yeah.
talking, and I'm trying to be
you
more
know?
Open to just
yeah,
talking.
Yeah, it's great. Talking is good.
You just mentioned your book.
Yeah.
Now, I have to confess, I own the book. I had not, we're all busy.
Yes.
I just hadn't sat down, read it cover to cover, you know, really marinated in it.
I
right?
wouldn't have expected you to.
And, but I did before this interview, and... So, first of all, I think I love the book.
Thank you.
I love it. And for people who haven't read it, the book is Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, Life. It's Missy's book, written in collaboration with Carrie King.
Yeah.
And I have to give a shout out to Evan Sung because
he's amazing.
Did the photo for the show.
He's amazing.
And he's my buddy. But so, Missy, what was behind this book? So, for people who don't know, and the word life in the title is the giveaway. Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, it is, as I said to you before we started recording, it's a cookbook, but then it's also this other book that kind of coexists in the same space and time as the cookbook.
Yeah.
It's your life story. That's not unusual in a cookbook. Certainly, chefs always tell, you know, this is how I started cooking, and And then I went and spent time here, and I went and cooked for these people, and then I opened my own place.
It's a little deeper than that.
But then you go into the time you took, like, what would you call it, a sabbatical? The time you took away from the...
I like to call it retirement, and I came back.
Realized it wasn't feasible.
Yes, exactly.
But you took quite a bit of time away from the kitchen. You talk about getting in shape. You talk about your love of Pilates. Yeah. You talk about... You talk about kind of finding yourself and what you want your, not your professional life, but what you wanted your life to be. And somehow it all comes together in a way where it makes total sense that periodically, you know, that stops. And then here's five recipes, right?
Yeah.
So what made you want to share yourself in that way?
Well, I'm not sure that I would have made the same decision now as I made then. At the time that I proposed the book and I sold the book, I didn't have Lilia. And I wasn't as... I didn't have the notoriety that I have today, and it wasn't as scary to put yourself in the public. I just thought I was writing a cool story that maybe some people would read.
Yeah.
And at the time, I felt like I was... I left my job...
Yep.
In 2013, I said I would take a year off.
Yes.
It took 2.5 to actually get to the point where Lilia opened. I did not know what I wanted to do. I really struggled. I knew I needed some time off. I knew I wanted to clear my head. And in that process, I felt like I was having all these experiences and all these emotions and all these things. And maybe I had a story to tell that maybe could resonate with some people and maybe could help people or maybe inspire people or maybe just tell a funny story here and there.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a little more serious than I anticipated. So when we kind of conceived the essay ideas, Carrie and I sat down and we talked about all my experiences through the year and travel and this and that. And then I wrote a lot of the book after Lilia opened. So my life changed quite a bit. And the perspective on some of those experiences was obviously in hindsight. And I mean, it's true to what happened, obviously. But as you're writing and something's happened 6 months before, your perspective changes a little. So I think that the impetus for the book was I went through this experience. I don't want to just write another cookbook on Italian food. I didn't have a Lilia book to write. I was probably at the end of my sabbatical, so to speak, and was probably getting bored and had no purpose and nothing to do, and was like, oh, I'm going to write a book. And I had always wanted to write a book. I explored it a lot when I was at Avoce. I had some ideas. I had beginnings of proposals that never came to fruition for whatever reason. And this just felt right at the time. I was cooking all of the stuff at home. I had never cooked at home before. I mean, I'd cooked at home, but not like I was here. And I felt like I was making all this delicious food that was, a lot of it was very healthy because of a new diet I had started. Yep. And I just felt like it was a book that people would use, hopefully. And I didn't know if people would read the essays or not. I had no idea if people would, and they are. Yeah. And I'm getting a lot of great feedback on them. And if you can inspire a few people, I don't think I'm going to inspire 100,000 people, but if you can inspire a few people here and there, my cooks have read it and have come to me and said, you really inspired me. I want to get better. I want to do better. Like, and that to me, if I can inspire a couple people just on my team, that's really cool.
Yeah.
But it was a very hard, definitely a really hard process to go through and exposing yourself. And I was really nervous to when it kind of came out of, you know, how will people react to this? And people are reacting really, I mean, there's nothing bad in it, obviously, but it's definitely personal.
Yeah. It's interesting because hearing you talk about the book reminds me of how you talked about Lilia, that you did this thing that was sort of uniquely you, true to you, that you did in your way, that you sort of found your way to, and said, you know what, I'm going to put this out there and see what happens.
Yeah.
Right?
And
it seems like you came to both of those things in a very similar way.
I had a lot of time to think, Andrew.
Right, I was going
to
say, but also at a time in your life where you, I mean, you say in the book, you say, you know, I'm not quite middle-aged yet, but, you know, but maybe at a time, people do get to a time in your life where you just kind of don't care as much about I don't know, maybe making a misstep or what people might think, or, you know, like,
yeah, I definitely
just kind of like, this is what I want to do and I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And I think there are certainly consequences to that if it doesn't work,
of course.
I think, and I don't view opening Lulia as a major risk. It's not how I viewed it. I just viewed it as I'm not sure what's going to happen. And a lot of that had to do with coming to Williamsburg and not understanding Williamsburg, right, and not knowing it. And it just turns out that Williamsburg is just another part of the city.
Yeah.
And it's
spoiler
just
alert.
It's
right.
just a neighborhood. Right. It's right. a neighborhood. Right. It happens yeah. to be across a bridge. I, by the way, now live in Williamsburg and I'm opening a second restaurant in Williamsburg. So yeah. it's now my home. And I would have, I mean, if you ask anyone who knew me, there is no way that any of those things would have happened. And I'm happy they did. It's you know, another phase of my life. And,
yeah.
And as much as I considered myself a Manhattanite and it was very important to me, you know, theoretically to me, success, you know, it's funny when I left Spiaggia, which was an amazing job in Chicago.
Yeah.
And Tony is my biggest mentor. Tony
Montuano.
Tony Montuano is my biggest mentor and one of my closest friends and really changed my career. But I knew I didn't want to live in Chicago and I knew that Spiaggia wasn't opening in New York. So
right.
he very supportively freed me yeah. into the world. And I also needed to do my own thing. I
yeah.
needed to see what it was like to be a chef on my own without sort of someone saying, this is my style. And I think every chef at some point in their career needs to do that. And I Tony taught me everything I know about Italian food and inspired me in so many ways. But I know that for me, when I came back from Chicago to New York, for me, one of the reasons, and this might sound ridiculous, to me, success meant being successful in New York. So I could have opened 10 restaurants in Chicago. I probably would have had a lot easier time, probably would have had a lot easier lifestyle. And I chose not to do that because I came up cooking in New York and I was a line yeah. cook in New York. And to me, I wanted to be like the chefs I worked for in New York. And that's, and it seems silly, but it did mean something. And then to kind of put that on a micro level, then it meant Manhattan and it didn't happen and Manhattan didn't happen. And maybe it'll happen someday. I don't really care anymore. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
Like it used to be, because I found that I love that I have a one story building and in Brooklyn
yeah.
and that I can have a patio and that the neighbors live across the street and that I'm not in a big building. And I love a lot of things about that. And, I love the neighborhood feel. I love
yeah.
walking to work every day and all of that stuff. So your perspective changes over time. And I think you have to, I think if there's one thing I've learned over the last 4 years since kind of conceiving Lulia and going through the building process and opening it and being here, it's definitely being open-minded. And I think I probably used to be a little bit more closed-minded. I'm never moving to Brooklyn. I'm not opening a restaurant in Brooklyn. And I think I've become so much more open-minded that it'll just make me better as a business person and an entrepreneur and a chef.
And a person.
Yeah, well, yes, and a person.
But don't you feel it? No, the reason I'm saying this is I have friends who probably will be annoyed that I said this, but I'm not gonna name any of you guys.
Name them.
No, I will not name them. But, you know, I have friends. I have this argument all the time, and a lot of them are in the business, right? And I feel like I feel like you don't want to let yourself ever become old, right? And part of that is staying open to the fact that things change. Things change.
Yeah.
They change. It used to be, of course, you'd want to be in Manhattan. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, you know, name a important restaurant in Brooklyn, you would have been hard-pressed, right?
Yeah.
But now, I mean, there really isn't any...
It doesn't matter.
That has changed. And I think people who... You know, it's like people who are... A lot of people, you know, who are horrified that you can go to the grill, you know, the new Four Seasons restaurant, and you don't have to wear a jacket. And that's just horrifying to people. Things change.
Yeah.
It's funny to me that
change is tough. I mean, sometimes
yes.
that's tough.
And it's not always better.
This change for me has been great. It's maybe not for everyone. And it took me... I'm talking to you 2 years after I opened.
Sure.
It took me a long time to kind of understand what I was doing after I moved here. You know,
yeah.
I was in the West Village for 8 years after I came home from Chicago. I had always lived in Manhattan in the previous 9 years that I lived in New York, and that was home to me. And
yeah.
when I moved to Williamsburg, and because I work here and I wasn't going into the city as much at all when I moved here. I mean, I was going in, but
yeah.
I was going in for purposes.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't feel like I moved to a new neighborhood. I felt like I moved to a new city, and it was weird for me. But I've now adjusted, and I think about a month ago, finally admitted that I really like living here.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'm not as like, oh my God, I'm going to move back to Manhattan in 2 years or whatever. I don't know what's going to happen in 2 years. And that's
so,
the beauty is that I'm more
yeah.
open-minded to it.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. I was in Manhattan forever. I came to college in Manhattan, stayed in Manhattan. And then we were going to move, and ultimately did, to Westchester maybe 7 years ago. And went to see a friend of mine in Brooklyn. This is how much I didn't even think about Brooklyn. And we thought, oh, we could go here. I mean, it was like a 20-minute subway
ride. And you
did,
right?
And we did. But the day that we moved our like stuff, right? And I remember driving to the new place, and we're going across the Brooklyn Bridge. And in my mind's eye, I pictured like the opening credits of like a 70s sitcom, like WKRP in Cincinnati,
yeah.
where somebody was like moving to a new city and starting over. To your point, that's what it felt like to us. I had the same sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, I don't
that you
feel
did.
Like that now.
No, I don't feel
I don't,
no, of
I don't feel
not.
Like that now, but at the time,
yeah.
it was a big change for
yeah,
me.
And I totally get it.
Williamsburg in particular, there aren't a lot of people on the streets here during the day.
Right.
Like, it's very quiet. And
it is.
So,
I parked right in front of the restaurant for this interview.
Yeah, it by no means feels like living in the suburbs, but it actually in many ways feels like living in Chicago, in my old neighborhood in
yeah.
Chicago, which is funny to me.
Yeah.
And my brother lives in Chicago and said the same thing when he came. He's like, oh my God, this is totally like Bucktown in Chicago.
Right.
And it is. And so it's, yeah, but I think you have to accept sort of change and differences and not compare things. And that's something I learned when I lived in Chicago, is that I spent 5 years in Chicago comparing Chicago to New York,
right.
which is a very big mistake. I was never going to like Chicago because I did that.
Yeah.
And I wish in a little bit in hindsight that I hadn't done that. I always kind of viewed Chicago as like, oh, I'm just going to like this little New York. And Chicago is nothing like New York.
Yeah.
There's nothing similar about it. They're very different cities. And
it's a Midwestern city.
It is definitely a smaller Midwestern city.
Yeah.
And I didn't hate Chicago,
right?
But it definitely it never felt like home to me,
right?
Ever,
yeah,
ever, ever.
Sure.
And Williamsburg for the first 6 months, 8 months, 9 months didn't feel like home to me either, and now it does.
Right.
So,
yeah, good.
You know, yeah.
Well, welcome home.
Thanks.
We're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna pick up. We are chatting with Chef Missy Robbins at her wonderful restaurant Lilia in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and we'll be right back.
Like a four-leaf clover, shining like the Danny Bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Inspired by the finely crafted tools built at the hands of friends in and around custom knife making, and with a love of all things food, Abe Shaw began forging a collection of culinary tools unlike any other. Collecting and working with custom and handmade knives for over a decade, Abe has developed a deep respect and admiration for the artists, metalsmiths, woodworkers, and craftspeople behind the endless interpretations of these ancient tools that feed us, the most intimate tools in our lives. They needed a showcase, and Eating Tools was born. The curated collection of unique and extraordinary handmade culinary utensils you'll find here, along with a hand-picked selection of top-quality production-made pieces, represents a catalog of products never before assembled in one place. Many of these products can only be found at Eating Tools. Food, cooking, craftsmanship, and art are their ingredients. There's no substitute for having the right tool for the job, and Eating Tools promises to bring you just that. They think you'll agree that the food-loving visionaries behind each of their products has an eye for the tools we use every day. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
What you gonna do with your hard-won prize?
And we are back chatting with Chef Missy Robbins at Lilia. So, Missy, can we talk for a minute? You were just mentioning Tony Montewano. You had a couple of really important chefs early in your career.
Oh, yeah.
Can we talk about a couple of them
yes.
for a few minutes?
Who do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about Charlie Trotter.
Well, I didn't work for him.
No, but he was an important person in your...
Sure.
He contributed to your... to a turning point in your life.
He made me want to be a chef.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 22 years old and a senior in college, and we were spending Thanksgiving in Chicago with my grandmother lived there, and my brother, I think, had just moved there.
Yeah.
And we went to Charlie Trotter's to celebrate my brother's birthday.
Yeah.
And, you know, this Saturday or whatever after Thanksgiving, and I kind of ate this meal, and through it, I had been thinking about the restaurant thing, and I always thought that I'd go to college and go have another career and open a restaurant later in life for fun, which now I think it's so funny that I thought
that,
it was for
that
fun.
That was going to be like that. Your chuck it all
yeah,
fantasy.
I don't think so.
No. No, maybe
but
a
at
juice
the time,
bar.
At the time, bar. You know, people who went to Georgetown University weren't becoming chefs, and it wasn't a cool thing to do, and it just I'm not sure. I thought it was an acceptable thing to do at the time.
Sure. Roughly, what year are we talking?
1992.
Okay.
Yeah, was when I had this meal and I started cooking in 93.
Okay.
So 1992, and I found out a childhood friend of mine from Connecticut had gone to Northwestern and was cooking, doing an apprenticeship, as we used to call them, with Charlie Trotter.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, if she can cook, I can cook. and I had this meal at Charlie Trotter's, and I was like, okay, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. I want to have a restaurant just like this. I was
so funny.
Fascinated by every element of it. It wasn't just the food. It was the food. It was the plates. It was the you know, glassware. It was the service. It was the attention to detail.
Yeah.
It was how the menu was written. It was every single little thing. And it was the townhouse it was in.
Yeah.
It was walking up the stairs to get, I was fascinated. And I had grown up in this world with my family where I had been to a lot of fancy restaurants like Charlie Trotter's, which sort of inspired it. And Charlie Trotter's was sort of the culmination. But you mentioned the Four Seasons. I grew up going to the Four Seasons for special occasions. And my dad would say, where do you want to go? I grew up about an hour and a half from the city and
in
Connecticut.
Yeah.
And he would say, where do you want to go? And I don't even know how I knew what the Four Seasons was, but we would go to the Four Seasons and Shenley Palace. And
oh my gosh.
I ate at Le Gavroche in London, which is a 3-star Michelin restaurant when I was 12. And I can tell you almost every single thing I ate on the plate. I mean, that's just not normal. People shouldn't remember what they ate when they were 12 at a 3-star Michelin restaurant. And, so I ended up writing Charlie Trotter a letter. My friend, Megan Conway, she's in Vegas. She's been there for many years. She's a great pastry chef.
Uh-huh.
She said, you can write him. He's never going to respond to you. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. She's like, I had knocked on the door a lot. I lived here. And I said, okay. And so I wrote him this letter and I was like, okay, I'm never going to hear from this guy. And I didn't know anything about the business. I didn't know about protocol.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to hold a knife. I didn't know what was appropriate, not appropriate. I had no idea. And I still have the letter that I wrote him. I have all my cover letters.
You made a copy of it?
You
Xeroxed it?
Well, you didn't Xerox it. It was like typed. Like it was way before email. Like you didn't send a resume through email.
But I mean, you mailed him the letter.
I mailed him a letter, but I have copies of it.
Because you'd written it like on your computer.
No,
or something.
And I think I had like a bunch of copies that I mean, maybe my word processor.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I had a real computer then.
Right.
I think I had a word, like a brother word
a
processor.
Dot matrix printer.
something weird like that. And he responded about a couple of weeks later. I got a call. I was Thursday. I remember this so vividly. I lived in a townhouse in Georgetown, this awesome townhouse that I had no business living in with three roommates. And I remember being upstairs in my room and my roommate called up and she said, hey, some dude named Charlie's on the phone for you. And I was like, what? And I got on the phone and the guy grilled me. I mean, he grilled me and I had no idea. So like, I couldn't say wrong answers cause I had no idea what I was talking about. So it didn't matter. It wasn't, I had no idea. And he said, well, why don't you come out here for a couple of days? Why don't you take some time off of school and come out here? And I was like, I'm in school. And he's like, yeah, come out here. So my grandmother at the time had an apartment on Lakeshore Drive and she was in, I think in California those days during the winter. So I went out. I think I took like a week off of school. I don't know why I was thinking that was okay. And I went out and I stayed in my grandmother's apartment and I knocked on the door for my stage at Charlie Trotter's. And the guy answers the phone, I mean the door, and he says, yeah, weren't you supposed to be here next week? And I mean, the look on my face, oh my gosh, terrified. I was a kid. I was 22 years old. And he said, oh, I'm just kidding. And I was like, okay, definitely not funny.
Right.
And then I staged there for 2 days. They were pretty terrifying.
How so?
Well, I mean, it was a very formal kitchen with a lot of cooks, and I was nervous, and I didn't have a skill set, and I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing, and the cooks would start talking to me, and they would start asking me questions, and then they would say, shh, here he comes, don't talk. And I'd be like, what? And everyone was terrified of him, but I was fascinated. I was fascinated by it, and he wouldn't really give me an answer as to whether he was going to hire me or not. And I was graduating from college, and I had, in the meantime, he said, why don't you go get some experience? And he told me to go talk to Jean-Louis Peladen, who also has passed away. I marched down to Jean-Louis at the Watergate with my little resume in hand on really nice resume paper. Yeah. I didn't have a resume. I had done a bunch of internships in the art world. I was an art history major, and I left it off at the front desk. And sure enough, he called me. Like amazing. A few days later, and he said, listen, I don't have room in my kitchen for you. Thank you. I understand Charlie sent you here. I don't have room.
Yeah.
I said, okay, no problem. So there was a restaurant called 1789 that was above my bar called The Tombs at Georgetown.
Right.
And 1789 was the place where, you know, a lot of like important DC people ate there, but it was also the place where you took your parents for parents' weekend at Georgetown.
Like the dress up.
Yeah. It was fancy. It was fancy continental. Yeah, right. So I knocked on the door. I used to see the chefs coming down to the bar all the time. Yeah. And I went and knocked on the door and I said, I really want to work here. I'll work for free. I'll do anything. I just want to learn. I don't know what I'm doing. They said, okay, you can be here every Friday and Saturday. And I said, Friday and Saturday? I'm a senior in college. Yeah, no. And they're like, you want to work here? You have to be here Fridays and Saturdays. Come in at 4:00. I said, okay. Again, what do I have to lose?
Yeah.
If I wasn't doing it for money. I didn't have to have a job. I was doing it because I wanted to see if I liked it. And if I didn't like it, I could quit.
But was it more than that, Missy? Like, did you have this, I mean, you just talked about going from Chicago to, I mean, I know you were going back to where you were based, but you know, you're like, one second you're at Trotter's and then you said,
well, I hadn't graduated yet.
No, I understand that. But you were like, so I marched over to Jean-Louis. I mean, it's, you know, but you were just, you were in Chicago, then you were at Jean-Louis, then you were at this other place. Like, did it seem?
No, I wanted
like
to get a job.
More than something you were just interested in?
No, I was definitely I just didn't know how to get in. And when Charlie Trotter says, go try and get a job at Jean-Louis and then we'll talk, I think
you're
said, I think you should get experience while you're finishing college.
Okay.
While you're finishing school. Yeah. And so at that point, I started cooking in February of 1993. I graduated in May.
Yeah.
And I probably went to Trotter's in December or January for that stage. Okay. And so he said while I was there, maybe I need to backtrack a little. He said while I was there, I think you should go get some experience while you're finishing school. We'll keep talking, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I ended up working at 1789 every Friday and Saturday from that February until I graduated. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I could also get down to the bar through a secret stairway and never have to wait in line again. And and it just was kind of became this thing. My friends were already downstairs and I would finish work at 11:30. And I loved the energy of the kitchen. I never looked at my watch.
Yeah.
I just like kind of did it. It seemed like I was good at it. I had no idea what I was doing, but I worked with these very patient guys who wanted to teach me. And Charlie Trotter wouldn't give me an answer. And I had plans to travel through Europe after I graduated. And I did need to get a job. I was done with school. And and I went to the guys at 1789 and said, listen, I'm going to travel. I'm learning so much here. I'd like to come back in August or September and work here full time. And they said, great, go, come back, eat, taste a lot of food. And I ended up working there for a year. I never pursued the Charlie Trotter thing.
Yeah.
I still think with all due respect to Chef Trotter, I still think to this day that I probably wouldn't be in this business if I had gone to work for him.
Really?
I think it would have been too much? I think it would have been too much for me. I think it would have been an environment that I would not have thrived in very well. I wouldn't have known that at the time, and I sort of discovered that through the years that, like, I wonder if I would have made it. You know, I know how hard his kitchen was. I know how tough it was. I know some of the guys who came out of his kitchens. It was a very tough place, and I never really chose kitchens like that throughout my whole career. But, you know, going back to the genesis of you bringing this up, he did make me want to be a chef. And I will tell you, when he passed away a few years ago, I was in a restaurant in Milan, and my brother texted me, who still lives in Chicago, and said, "Hey, Trotter died." And I like welled up.
Wow.
It was so weird. I barely knew him. I had seen him in Chicago, and I had done events with him and stuff like that, but I wasn't close with him by any means. But I remember, like, I teared up. I was sitting at dinner and I was like, wow. But he obviously had an impact, so.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I can see you're a little emotional now talking about
it. Isn't that weird?
It is. But, you know, it's also interesting when you say, like, you know, if he had taken you, maybe you wouldn't have stayed there. You know, it's funny how these moments and these things that happen and don't happen can just totally change a I mean, it's true of anybody, but totally change a chef's path. There's a chef named John Sedler who most recently had a place called Rivera in Los Angeles, which didn't last as long as it should have. Just an amazing, it was a 4-star LA Times restaurant when they were still given stars. And it was an amazing restaurant. And back in the day, he had a place called St. Estef. And he did food that was kind of based on the flavors of his, he had grown up in New Mexico, right? Had a Latino family. And he was hugely influenced by this chef, Jean Bertrand. And the funny thing was, he had tried to go to work for Wolfgang Puck. And Wolfgang said, come back tomorrow. And that same afternoon, he went over and knocked on the door of Bertrand's place and ended up working for the guy for, I think, a couple of years, totally influenced by his plating techniques and his visual style and a lot of other things about the guy. That one day, and the fact that Wolfgang said, come back tomorrow, completely affected, like, his entire arc of his career.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's...
And
I
if
think
you
that's
had caught Charlie on a different day, you know, maybe, who knows? Maybe you'd be not... Maybe we wouldn't be... Maybe this restaurant wouldn't exist.
Exactly. And
it's
I
amazing.
Think, you know, I've made my decisions since then pretty calculated. Like, every decision I've made has sort of been to get to the next point in my career, or what skill can I learn that I haven't learned yet, or how do I get to the next level? And they've always been really calculated moves. They've never been really rash, like, crazy decisions. I've always, you know, left jobs with lots of notice and sort of gone. I've always had something to go to. And I think, you know, it's funny. I talk sometimes about, I worked at the Soho Grand Hotel for 3.5 years, which no one talks about in any press about me. No one knows, no one cares about. Sometimes I don't care about it, but it was 3.5 years of my training. And it was an interesting time for me, and it was a job I didn't love. It wasn't very food focused or beverage focused. It was a very hip place.
It was fabulous.
Downtown.
Yes,
it was very fabulous.
Yes.
I was not that fabulous. It was like I was so out of place there. And I will tell you, though, that it led me to the next step. And what I did learn at the Soho Grand, which I'm always so grateful for, is I learned how to read a P&L for the first time. I'd never seen a spreadsheet before. I didn't study business. I didn't ever work in a business environment. And I was, you know, at the time that I was probably 9 years into cooking or so.
Right.
When I started working there, I was 29.
Yeah.
29. I had just come back from Italy. And, I learned skills. I learned how to deal with an HR department. I learned how to run a bigger kitchen. I learned, but the most significant thing I learned is definitely understanding the finances of a business. And when I went to go to Spiaggia and apply to Spiaggia, one of the things that I think landed me that job was that I had very fine dining experience, but I also had this kind of other thing of understanding corporate world.
Yeah.
that really was necessary at Spiaggia. It's part of a very big company, and you had to know how to use a computer, and you had to know how to deal with numbers and all that stuff. And I wasn't certainly not an expert at it, but I understood it, and I understood the importance of it, and I definitely know that that helped me get the job there.
So the moral of the story is that there's value in...
Still be open-minded. There's value in everything. There's value in every... Even if you don't love a job or even if you don't think it's the right thing, I certainly never intended to stay at the Soho Grand for 3.5 years.
Right.
They kept giving me promotions. Yeah. I started as a junior sous chef. I ended up as a chef de cuisine.
Yeah.
I was allowed to explore my creativity there for the first time. So there were reasons to stay there.
Sure.
Three of my best friends came out of that job, which is amazing. I mean, really close friends. And I think we bonded because none of us were particularly thrilled there.
Right.
But we all loved being with each other and had a really good time. And I had a lot of laughs and were creating something and
that
trying to do something.
Yeah.
So I think there's value. I think the moral of the story is that there is massive value in sort of everything you do, even when it's tough or it doesn't feel like the right fit or you feel like you're kind of flailing because, you know, I felt inadequate because I wasn't in fine dining and I left fine dining.
Yeah.
And I felt like I kind of ruined my chances to get that. I mean, one of the reasons I went to Spiaggia is because I was really excited about what they were doing and I love Tony, but I also kind of knew I wasn't going to get a chef de cuisine job at a 4-star restaurant in New York, having been out of the scene for three and a half years. So I think everything kind of leads to the next thing and has purpose. And
I don't know if I would have been able
to tell you that 10 years ago, but I can tell you that now.
Yeah. Do you, just before we move on from it, you know, you've described a little bit in your story of, you know, knocking on a kitchen door and sending the letter. I know people don't send letters anymore. I mean, who does really?
But no, once in a while.
Once in a while, I'll still mail a thank you note. But if you know, most stuff business happens with email now, that's fine. Or even texting in your business.
Yeah.
But it's funny, whenever someone tells me they can't reach a chef by email, I'm like, did you text?
It's true. It's very, very true.
Pro tip.
Ask my mother. She'll tell you the same thing.
Text the chefs. Don't email the chefs.
My mother now texts me to see if she can call me.
That's fine.
And I told her to stop doing that. I was like, can you just call me? And she said, well, you don't pick up. And I said, well, I'll pick up when I want to pick up.
It freaks people out now when you call them. I know people who don't want to touch the phone. Like
I'm a little bit like that in many ways, but I've recently decided I think people should have more phone contact.
I love phone contact.
I'm working on it.
So you mentioned doing a new place.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. There's a story in your book about talking to Danny Meyer and him saying, you know, are you most happy when you have a pan in your hand? Well, why don't you go ahead? What was your answer to
that? It was a great moment. I mean, I met with Danny sort of for advice and sort of maybe in hopes of partnering with him. And he was generous enough to give me a lot of his time. And it was an amazing moment. I had known Danny through the years, but I hadn't known him and gotten to sit in his office and talk to him. And he asked me this one question. I mean, he asked great questions. And he asked me this one question that really kind of made me think a lot. And he said to me, you know, when are you happiest? Are you happiest when you have a pan in your hand? And I was like, no, not at all. I'm happiest when I'm planning and mentoring and creating and teaching. And I like being in the kitchen, but I don't necessarily want to cook every day, all day. Like it's not where I am anymore.
Yeah.
And part of that is a physical thing. I, you know, at the time I had a massive ankle problem and a massive shoulder problem and my body was broken and it's much better now. But if I was cooking the way I used to cook, it wouldn't be better.
Yeah.
It would be very challenging for me, I think. And it just made me think about what I wanted and what kind of restaurant I needed to open in order to make that happen. And so I had been looking at an enormous amount of spaces in the West Village and downtown Manhattan. And aside being from very expensive, they were small. And I always wanted a small restaurant. I always wanted my little 30-seat place. I mean, that was always my goal, was to have this tiny little restaurant. And somehow I ended up in the Avoces of the world having 180 seats and not knowing what to, you end up on this path. And I don't regret the path, but I always wanted this small place. And what I quickly realized was if I opened a tiny little restaurant that had an enormous rent in the West Village, I was going to have to be in the kitchen every day because I wouldn't be able to afford a chef de cuisine or a sous chef or a pastry chef or all these things. And so as I started kind of developing what I wanted and where I was going to do something, it sort of became very evident that I needed a restaurant that was going to generate enough volume that I could have those things, and I could have a chef working with me, and that I could have a pastry chef running the cafe, and all those things. And I think that was a really great question of him to ask, and it made me think a lot, and yeah. It sort of helped me to kind of go where I'm going.
So does that give you a certain... Because I think a lot of times when chefs go from their first restaurant to having two restaurants, right, that there's, for some of them, it's a, there's like a crisis of time management and like, where do you want to be and how, you know, who am I now, you know? It seems to me like having had that revelation, you're pretty well set up, or, you know, I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, but it seems like psychologically you're in a good place to do a second restaurant.
I am, and I that was always the plan. I mean, the plan was never to just have one restaurant and never do another thing again.
Yeah.
And I think it's always difficult to kind of step away and separate yourself and have someone else execute for you on a daily basis and not necessarily be able to be here as much. One of the reasons why we're opening in Williamsburg is so that we could touch every restaurant every day.
Yeah.
And I know that if we had opened... And again, that might not hold true in 2 years.
Forever,
but,
right.
But for now, for number two, I think it became really important to us that we were in the neighborhood-ish. It's a 20-minute walk away. It's not right here.
Yeah.
It's in a different part of Williamsburg, and the neighborhoods are sort of different. And I do think it became, it just became sort of evident that I wanted to be able to be at both restaurants, and I think I will be able to do that. Obviously, when you open a new restaurant, your attention gets very focused on that new restaurant, and there's a lot, you know, sort of riding on that and all that stuff. But I do think I'll be able to be present here, and also living in the neighborhood makes it easier as well. And but yeah, I think in terms of opening a second restaurant, I've done it. I did it at Avoce.
Sure.
You have to trust people. And I think I trusted people at Avoce. I had two amazing chef de cuisines, three amazing throughout the whole Avoce, who were amazing, and they understood my vision and my expectations, and they worked so hard to make that happen. And by the end, the menus were 95% theirs and ours together.
Yeah.
And I hope that happens, you know, with Lilia and the next place, because Lilia was so personal to me that I haven't let go in terms of creativity, and I'm not 100% ready to still. But at some point I'm going to have to, at some point you have to let other people do things. But I will say I do have an enormous amount of trust in my staff. And you know, just for various reasons over the last 5 months, I don't expedite as much as I used to. And it's been sort of great for them, I think.
Yeah.
They feel more ownership of me not standing there controlling every little thing that happens in the kitchen. And I feel better, and I feel better that I can be here but not have to stand in one place. And I think it's kind of good for everyone.
So I don't want to ask you to give away stuff earlier than you want to, but I do.
I'm giving away nothing.
But about the new place, I have a question.
Yes.
This restaurant being what it was, the way we talked about it, being such a personal expression, and you having poured so much of what you had to pour into a place into this place, when you think about the new place, how do you think about it? In other words, is there, you know, X number of years of Missy Robbins on planet Earth that goes into the new place and that takes care of itself concept-wise? Is it, do you think of it as an adjunct or spinoff to Lilia? Do you think of it as a sister restaurant? How would you term it in your own head?
I think of it as another passion project, and something. It's something that I've actually wanted to do for a very long time. It's not something new that I came up with. It's something that I conceived of a while ago, and it wasn't appropriate for the Lilia space, and it didn't make sense to do it as the first thing. Actually, So I think, yes, without giving away anything, it's just another passion project. I think at this point in my cooking, I have a style. I'm not going to be cooking Japanese food all of a sudden, though that would be really fun. But
it would be.
But it's not what I do. I think people know what I do, and they know what I do well.
Yeah.
And it'll be an extension of what I do well. It is not a Lilia. It is something else.
So it will be distinctly Missy Robbins.
It'll definitely be distinctly Missy Robbins.
But there won't be any sibling rivalry between the
there
two restaurants.
There will definitely not be sibling rivalry between the two restaurants. That makes sense. Both, this is my firstborn. Yeah. I mean, Lilia is right. My firstborn.
Right.
One of the reasons why I don't want to replicate Lilia is because I don't want to replicate Lilia.
Yeah.
Because I think Lilia is about this the space and the time and the place
totally.
And the people here. And
totally.
I think it is a special restaurant for me, and I think for a lot of other people now. And I think to try and do that is you know, and I've certainly gotten offers to do it in many cities.
I'm sure.
And I just think there's something really unique about this space. And
yes.
Could I go find another warehouse in another city and do something like this? Yes. But I like sort of the idea of just doing something different right now. And still being in my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And it will be in my comfort zone. I think, you know, I've spent the last several months sort of working on design, which is really fun for me. And that's, you know, you talk about the pan in the hand or not in the hand. And
yeah.
the design aspect has become something that has always been something that I'm really interested in and
right.
have a very, very strong hand in. It's not like I just handed the space to an architect and said, here, go. This is what I like.
Yeah.
I'm really involved in picking every material and every detail, and I'm kind of, for better or worse, a little bit vigilant about it, with still giving the architect a lot of freedom to do their thing, because
yeah.
that's their creators also. But I definitely have a vision, and I definitely have a design style. There's no question about it, and I'm not really looking to reinvent that. I'm
yeah.
looking to kind of expand upon it and say
yeah.
how do we stay within kind of my comfort zone and style of design without making it look like Lilia. Because
yeah.
I don't want it to look exactly like Lilia, but I also sort of want people to understand, like, oh yeah, this looks like something Missy would do.
Right. Love it.
Which also kind of reflects my house and everything
yeah.
else I do.
Well,
so.
You know, it's funny. I think about this, the way you talked about this space and this place and this time and all of that. It reminds me when people talk about, like, great writing, no matter how much work goes into it, it ought to feel like it just sort of happened, right? And there is... And I don't mean by that it's overly casual or seems thoughtless or thrown together, but I do think a lot of my favorite restaurants, they do feel almost like they just kind of sprung up where they are, you know? And there is that feeling here. It feels very, not obviously I don't mean this word in the agricultural sense, but it feels very organic.
Yeah, and more... I mean, part of that is that I'm blessed with amazing bones at Lilia.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
yes.
I have a beautiful ceiling
yeah.
that we barely touched. I have
right.
windows that we refurbished. I have brick that
yeah.
existed. I have high ceilings. I didn't have to do a lot here.
Yeah.
You know, the new space is in a new building. It's in a new building. It's a raw space. It's bigger than this. And so it does require a different sort of vision to how do we take this very raw space and give it some character and make it, it's not going to be like Lilia. It can't be. It's,
yeah.
it's a, this yeah. is just a unique building,
yeah.
but how do you kind of re-envision a very blank space to give it some character and charm?
Love it.
And hopefully it works.
Great. Well, I can't wait for it.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my first guest of the new year.
Honored.
And thanks for letting me come interview you at my favorite restaurant.
Of course. Thank you. This was
great.
Fun.
All the best for 2018.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. And that's our show. A huge thank you to Chef Missy Robbins for being our first guest of season 2. And our first guest of 2018. I hope you all will get a chance at some point to visit Lilia Restaurant in Williamsburg. As I said at the top of the show, it is probably my favorite restaurant right now. I just adore that restaurant. And as Missy said, it is just craveable food served in a warm setting. That sounds so simple, but it's so elusive. Especially at the level that she does it without being a show-off about it. Thanks, as always, to my wife, Caitlin, for joining me for the show's introduction, and to David Tatasciore. David, hello, Happy New Year. Thank you for splicing these shows together for us. You're the best engineer in the world, in my opinion, and I really appreciate your extra work to make this show happen. You can subscribe to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Stitcher, and iTunes. And if you take a moment to rate or review the show in Apple's iTunes store, we'd really love you for that. It helps people find us and we appreciate it more than we could possibly tell you. You can follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram at ToklandAndrew is my handle. And you can follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Chef Podcast. And I would just tell anyone listening who only follows me personally that pretty soon I will not be posting about the show on my personal account. So for news and alerts about interviews and other things having to do with the show, please do follow at Chef Podcast, even if you follow me personally, because that personal feed will soon not be useful as far as this show is concerned. And if you'd like to read my musings and interviews with chefs, you can visit Toklan.com, my newly reinvigorated blog. That's TOQUELAND.com. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening, and I'll look forward to seeing you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.